Davy Crockett and Bigfoot battle it out. A mini Wormwood meteor hits a U.S. military base, or at least near to it. And we have a shadow banned interview for you. All that and more on today's JPD Weekly. Welcome to Josh Peck Disclosure Weekly. It is good to be with you again today. So I wanted to start off with a strange story. You know, this Bigfoot topic seems to keep coming up again and again, but that's not a bad thing. So I recently came across this this theory that Davy Crockett might have encountered Sasquatch, or, you know, Bigfoot. Now, we can only imagine some of the incredible things seen by the first pioneers on the American frontier. I mean, there's untouched reservoirs, fields of meadows with no roads, and skylines made only from mountaintops. But greater still is the excitement that came with experiencing new flora and fauna. But of all the documented wildlife encounters, none quite comes close to the harrowing claims by Davy Crockett. Now, for those who aren't familiar, Davy Crockett was well-known in America as a national icon. In the 1800s, he swooped into society with impeccable military prowess and maintained a respectable position in Congress for many years. But the political lifestyle soon took its toll, and Davy decided to head west to Texas with a crew of his own. And the team was determined to reach the new land despite the ongoing territory dispute with Mexico. Now, it was on this journey that Davy Crockett encountered an incredible sight worth recounting in a letter to his brother-in-law. So Davy recounted events from the frightening experience. The men had been hard at work all day, tolling away in the infamous Texas heat. He was clearing brush from a thicket alongside William Patton. The two were exhausted and stopped for a well-deserved break. Mr. Crockett put his tools down and began to wipe his brow, but no sooner did he cast his axe aside, a huge monster apparently appeared before his eyes. Now, he described the creature as a large ape-like monster. The beast was covered from head to toe with thick fur and had small beady eyes. He recalled huge rows of teeth visible and towering above him. The monster had an incredibly foreboding presence. Davy Crockett claims to have spit out his food in fear at the sight of this thing. But perhaps the strangest part of the entire encounter was what the beast did next. Instead of viciously attacking the men, the creature instead had a message. Davy Crockett recounted the warning he received from the monster. Apparently, the monster said, "Return from Texas, flee this fort, and abandon this lost cause." Now, of course, he was at a loss. This was surely the strangest encounter of his entire journey. He spoke up to the monster, questioning his message, but it was to no avail. Before he could indulge himself with the grace of an explanation, the monster disappeared before his eyes. He described the exit like morning steam swirls off of a frog pond. Now, the experience left Davy Crockett completely unsettled. He described in his letter an inability to consume meat for a couple of days following the experiment, or the experience, excuse me. Davy Crockett had an honest reputation through years of loyalty to his country through military and political service. The man was also well known for his strong Christian values, which he outlined himself in the letter. Davy swears by the encounter, not once but twice in the letter, to his brother-in-law. Now, was it the Texas heat or something much bigger that tried to warn Davy and his men? Only Davy and William Patton can definitely say what happened in Texas that day. And what we can do is just kind of speculate on that. You know, did he really see that or not? There was also stories that came out later recounting this, because this was in 1836 in Nacogdoches, Texas. That's when Davy Crockett and this Bigfoot prophecy thing happened. But this is what it said in the actual letter. This is Davy Crockett's own words. Quote, "William and I were pushing through some thicket, clearing the way when I sat down to mop my brow. I sat for a spell, watching as William made his good and fine progress. I removed my boots and sat with my rations, thinking the afternoon a fine time to lunch. As the birds whistled and chirped, I ate my small and meager ration. I tapped my axe upon the opposite end of the felled tree I rested upon. Whether it was the axe's disturbance or possibly the heat of the high sun, which caused an apparition to slowly form in front of our eyes, I know not. As a Christian man, I swear to you, Abe, that what spirit came upon me was the shape and shade of a large ape man, the likes we might expect among the more bellicose and hostile Indian tribes of the territories. The shade formed into the most deformed and ugly countenance. Covered in wild hair, with small and needling eyes, large broken rows of teeth, and the height of 3 foundlings, I spit upon the ground the bread I was eating. The monster then addressed a warning to me. Abner, it told me to return from Texas to flee this fort and to abandon this lost cause. When I began to question this, the creature spread upon the wind like the morning steam swirls off a frog pond. I swear to you, Abner, that whatever meat or sausage disagreed with me that afternoon, I forswore all beef and hog for a day or so afterward. So, you know, we all know what happened at the Alamo. Most Crockett scholars ignore this passage as a silly story to entertain his friend in a personal letter, and that could be the case, though some Bigfoot scholars remain convinced that the creature reached out and tried to save the frontiersman the horrible fate that was soon to befall him. Now, whether or not you believe in this, it's an interesting story, especially because he doesn't describe it necessarily as a physical animal or a physical being, but more of a spirit type of thing. Now, maybe like he seemed to hint at in the letter, maybe he had some food that had gone bad, and maybe it messed with him and it caused him to hallucinate. I don't know about that, or maybe it was some type of spirit trying to warn him of something. Now, typically, if something is looking like that, you would think that that would be something evil or demonic. Now, why an evil or demonic being would want to warn Davy Crockett about what was going to happen, who knows? It could be various things because of Indian tribes with certain beliefs in that area. That could just be the spirits that those tribes brought forth, or the whole thing could have been a big hoax. You know, maybe it was somebody playing a trick on him. There's a lot of different possibilities here, or it could just be that he made the whole thing up. You know, I mean, we can't completely discount that, but it's a really interesting story. It's an interesting piece of Bigfoot lore or mythology. And depending on how you take it, it's either evidence that there is some creature in the woods that's ape-like in appearance and larger than a man, or that thing is a spiritual entity of some kind, or it's nothing at all and it's just a part of people's imagination. But I came across this story. I personally had not heard it before, so it was interesting to me, and I wanted to bring it up on this show because it seems that quite a few people who follow this channel have an interest in Bigfoot, which is strange because up until recently I didn't really talk about Bigfoot that much. But I've said before, you guys run the show, you tell me what you like and I will cover it. And I've gotten a lot of response from previous Bigfoot videos. Again, as I've said on many other Bigfoot videos, I'm still torn on the issue and I still get blasted for that in the comments section, because people will say things like, you know, if you can't believe in Bigfoot after all the evidence, then there's just no hope for you. You just got your head in the sand. For one thing, I never said I didn't believe in Bigfoot, but I didn't say I do believe in it either. I don't know what to do with it. Like I've said in other videos, the evidence is subjective. It's always a personal encounter. Now, there have been certain, you know, DNA evidence and things like that, but even that is split on how to interpret it, because there's no definitive proof that everybody can agree on. You know, it's split. So there's two sides to even the physical evidence that's claimed to be in support of Bigfoot. So who knows? But I think it's an interesting story. And hey, if you're upset at me for not buying totally into it, at least you got somebody who's willing to talk about it, who's willing to talk about it, even if they're not completely sold on it. I mean, to me, that I would think that would be more interesting. To me, I'm interested in that. I don't want to hear like an ideologue or somebody who just mimics and parrots what everybody else says about a certain thing. I want to know what somebody thinks when they actually take time to think about it, and maybe their view isn't perfectly in line with everybody else's view on that topic. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I enjoy, especially when it comes to politics and things like that. So I would think that would be interesting. Maybe it's not for everybody. That's okay. But anyway, in any case, I would like to know what you think about this story with Davy. Did Davy Crockett actually experience Bigfoot here? Was it an animal? Was it a spirit? Was it nothing? Did he make it up? Did he have some bad food? Is this whole thing a hoax? Or is there something real to it? I would love to know what you think. Leave me a comment in the comment section below, either on YouTube or the many other platforms that I'm on. I just started up on One Way, MeWe, and Minds, so I'm on all that too. I would love to know what you think. Let me know. So the Air Force has continued to remain silent after what could be described as like a mini Wormwood, you know, from the prophecy in the Book of Revelation. But this huge meteor hits near a U.S. military base, and it exploded with 2.1 kilotons of force last month. But the U.S. Air Force has made no mention of the event. And that's strange. Now, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory confirmed an object of unspecified size traveling at 24.4 kilometers per second struck Earth in Greenland just 43 kilometers north of an early missile warning Thule air base on the 25th of July 2018. And for anybody who knows about Aleister Crowley and Thelema and Jack Parsons and all that, the word Thule will probably ring some bells. If not, that's okay. I actually have a book coming out with Stephen Bancars on the New Age movement that gets into all that stuff and it shows connections with occultism and how all that stuff is creeping into our churches. But getting back to the story, the director of the Nuclear Information Project for the Federation of American Scientists, Hans Christensen, tweeted about the impact, but America's Air Force has not reported the event at all. So Hans Christensen said, tweeted out, meteor explodes with 2.1 kilotons force, 43 kilometers above missile early warning radar at Thule Air Base. We're still here, so they correctly concluded it was not a Russian first strike. There are nearly 2,000 nukes on alert, ready to launch. A fireball was detected over Greenland on July 25th, 2018 by U.S. government sensors at an altitude of 43.3 kilometers. The energy from the explosion is estimated to be 2.1 kilotons. Now, Mr. Christensen argues that it's concerning there were no public warning from the U.S. Government about the incident, no warning at all. He writes on Business Insider, quote, had it entered at a more perpendicular angle, it would have struck the Earth with significantly greater force, end quote. Now, Mr. Christensen points to the example of the Chelyabinsk meteor, a 20 meter space rock that exploded in the air above Russia without warning on the 15th of February 2013. It was the size of a house, brighter than the sun, and visible up to 100 kilometers away. About 1,500 people were injured by glass from windows smashing or other effects of the meteor's impact as it crashed to Earth, and it's the biggest known human toll from a space rock. So NASA Planetary Defense Officer Lindley Johnson said about that event, quote, the Chelyabinsk event drew widespread attention to what more needs to be done to detect even larger asteroids before they strike our planet. This was a cosmic wake-up call, end quote. Now, following the 2013 incident, the International Asteroid Warning Network was established to assist governments to detect and respond to near-Earth objects, but an asteroid entering the Earth's atmosphere is not actually uncommon. According to a study referenced by Mr. Christensen, a meteor struck Earth every 13 days over a 20-year period. Most break apart upon entering the atmosphere and are relatively harmless. But it is interesting that the Air Force hasn't made any comment on this whatsoever. And of course, that's going to cause certain people to think that they're covering something up, or more realistically, they're just not very diligent, or they don't care. But, you know, as always, I'm curious to know what you think about this. I'd love it if you'd leave a comment in the comment section below. Why do you think that the military or the Air Force hasn't commented on this? Do you think it was something different than a meteor, or do you think there was something special about this impact that maybe shows? I tend to think that maybe they're embarrassed, that they didn't detect it beforehand, that they it could have hit this base. It could have made a lot more impact. It could have been a lot more destructive, and there wasn't anything that they could have done. They didn't know about it. I think that they're probably, it's more about saving face, you know, deny it until, or just ignore it until it goes away kind of thing. But that doesn't get at the central issue that these things happen, and it would be good if we would, if we could tell when one was about to happen. I don't know what we could do about it, but at least we would know, at least we could evacuate, something like that. I mean, if one of these were to hit a major city, for example, that would be pretty bad. And also, you know, Bible prophecy talks about this. And ultimately, from Bible prophecy, we know that there's going to come a time where something called wormwood is going to strike the earth. Now, there's different interpretations as to what that is. Some say that it is a meteor or an asteroid of some kind that's going to hit the earth and poison the waters. But others say that it's likened to a star because that in some contexts in the Bible is looked at as signifying angels. As stars are words used for angels sometimes. So maybe it's an angel that actually touches down, or maybe it's both. Maybe in the spiritual, it's an angel, but the way that it comes across to us physically in our human perception, you know, in the objective reality that we can actually observe, maybe in that, it's an asteroid, but in the spiritual realm, it's an angel. So, you know, there are different ways to look at it. And, you know, it's interesting to look at it from all angles and think what is the thing that's connecting all of these interpretations. So again, I would like to know what you think about the prophecy of Wormwood. Do you think that that is a meteor? Do you think it's an angel? Do you think it's something else? Do you think it is a literal star? I mean, there are people that do believe that. There are people that believe that the stars in the sky are not as big as science claims it is. I disagree with that, but you know, I'm still open to hear compelling arguments. It's just I have never heard any compelling arguments to that as of yet. But regardless, leave me a comment in the comment section below. Again, I'm on YouTube, DTube. I'm also on MeWe and One Way and Minds, and I'm kind of everywhere now. I'm exploring alternative social media because of the censorship going on at Facebook and YouTube. And actually, we do have something to talk about there. That'll come a little bit later. Continuing on, an astrophysicist who you've probably heard of predicts the end of human civilization is approaching and claims that this world is not our home. So a Christian astrophysicist, Hugh Ross, you're probably familiar with him, or at least have heard his name. He has warned believers that the end of human civilization is fast approaching. Hugh Ross believes that we will shortly enter the next ice age, the fulfillment of Jesus Christ's Great Commission, and ultimately the end of the world. In the third installment of his series, The End of Civilization as We Know It, with a question mark at the end, because apparently he's not sure, but Ross claims that humans may be able to delay the ice age for a period of time, but they will not be able to prevent it from happening. Though his careful analysis of ice age, careful analysis of ice age cycles, Ross concludes that the next ice age should have started 5,000 years ago, but that the emission of atmospheric carbon has delayed its arrival. And carbon is emitted largely through the domestication of cattle, deforestation, the use of fossil fuels, that kind of stuff. I don't know if you can really trace that back 5,000 years, though, at least not all of it. But he believes that this human activity has caused Earth to warm and the effects of the next ice age to be lessened. He says, quote, "I am not saying it is infeasible for humanity to find a way to delay the onset of the next ice age by one or two millennia, Nuclear fusion reactors, for example, conceivably could provide a means to desalinate huge quantities of ocean water. However, to cite another biblical principle and a famous Christian hymn, "This world is not our home," end quote, he writes. Now, Ross is urging Christians to take up the call of the Great Commission and spread the gospel throughout the world as the next ice age approaches. And sure, good advice. I don't know about the ice age part, but Great Commission, that's good. He says, quote, "To be clear, I am not saying that because it appears the Great Commission can be fulfilled within a few decades, that we can ignore the climate problems we currently face. Many Christians, including myself, believe that the Bible teaches a literal reign of Jesus Christ here on planet Earth for a 1,000-year period following the completion of the Great Commission," end quote. Now, the Canadian Christian apologist and old Earth creationist said that we should be grateful to live in a period of such climatic stability. Indeed, he warns, it could be much worse. But Ross believes that God has generously granted us an extremely beneficial ice age cycle, and with brief period of extreme climate stability within that cycle, so that we could not only enjoy a brief period of unprecedented wealth and technology, but also, far more importantly, to use that wealth and technology to fulfill an eternal spiritual destiny. So that's in his own words. The astrophysicist holds firm to his belief that Earth is billions of years old, but also posits a belief that living beings did not come into earthly existence by natural forces, but instead by the hand of God. He rejects the young Earth creationist view, which asserts that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. And he also disagrees with the assertion that God created the Earth in 24 period days, but instead believes that each of the 6 days in which Genesis 1 specifies that God was fashioning the planet refers to much longer periods of time. In a 2005 article for evidenceforchristianity.org, Hugh Ross explained his position on the length of time it took God to create the world. He said, quote, "Most Bible scholars and scientists, too, would agree that a correct and literal interpretation of the creation day is one that takes into account definitions, context, grammar, and relevant passages from other parts of Scripture. A careful analysis of all these elements yields many reasons for interpreting the creation days of Genesis as long periods of time. In the case of the creation days, long periods of time in which various life forms were introduced in increasing abundance and complexity are indeed discernible and significant for validating the supernatural accuracy of the writer's statements. If all creation were completed in 6 24-hour days, however, even the most sophisticated measuring techniques available would be totally capable of discerning the sequence of events, and thus a major purpose of the chronologue would be thwarted." Okay, so I don't know, personally, I don't know how to feel about Hugh Ross. I mean, I definitely believe he's a Christian. I definitely believe he is, for us Christians, he is our brother in Christ, and we should accept him as a brother in Christ. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to agree with all of his ideas or accept all of his premises. It doesn't mean that at all. He could be wrong on completely everything else. You know, who knows? But we do have to at least realize that he is our brother in Christ, and we're commanded by God to love each other. And actually, it says in Scripture, we can't love God unless we love each other. If we can't even get that right, there's no way we can know what love for God is even all about. So that part's incredibly important, and I want to bring that up because I'm sure people have very heated opinions about Hugh Ross's work. That's fine. Have heated opinions about his work. Now, him as a person, unless you know him personally, you can only really take your opinion so far. And you know, that should be left. But for those who would say, well, he's a false teacher, he's this or that, you know, there are many different ways to look at any one argument. And I would say, if you're going to say that he is teaching falsely, then you better be an expert on his point of view, preferably even more than he is, but at least as much as he is. You better be an expert on his point of view in order to know that it's wrong. You should know his point of view as well as you know your own. And I know I don't know his point of view that well. I would seriously doubt any random anonymous non-subscriber to this channel YouTube commenter would know his positions as well as he does. So until you can have that level of expertise, you should realize that your opinions are only your opinions. It's not objective fact, and continue the journey of learning. Now, that being said, we can share some opinions. My opinion is, I think that he's likely wrong on this. I don't think that we're headed towards another ice age, but again, I could very well be wrong on that. I don't have a deep understanding of the science, and I don't know if he is pulling something out of the Bible to support this, or if this is strictly science-based. I personally don't believe in overwhelming human human-made human-made problem with the climate warming up. I don't like a human-related I don't believe we have a big responsibility in that. Again, I could be wrong. I'm willing to be proved wrong, and I'm willing to hear out evidence on the other side. I think that's good, and we should be doing that. But from what I have researched into it, I don't believe that 97% of scientists of climate scientists agree. Or no, it's not climate science. It's 97% of scientists agree that the Earth is warming up and we are the major cause of it. That is actually not true. I did a video on that on Into the Multiverse that you can check out. It was, I think it's episode 101, if you want to check that out, if I remember right. But I am, as always, curious to know what you guys think about this. I would love to hear your opinions below. Just leave me a comment, and I'd love to check them out. That would be great. I want to talk about this scourge of pro-abortion, and I was actually kind of appalled, though I guess not surprised, on how many Christians actually claim a pro-abortion view. And still, now I'm not going to say that you can be saved and be pro-abortion, but I don't really believe that you can necessarily be a Christian in the sense that you're a strict follower of Christ, because it goes against, what do you need? I mean, it goes against the Bible. It goes clearly against his teachings about how we're supposed to treat children. It goes against the commandment in the Bible not to kill, not to murder. And the only way that you can have a moral outlook on abortion is if you if you convince yourself that the life in the womb is not really a life but a potential life, and that's not the case. Because we're just strictly from a Christian perspective, we're all born and we're all made in the image of God, right? So what is the image of God? A lot of people will say that, well, it's consciousness, or it's the ability to think, or it's self-awareness or something like that. Well, if that were the case, then a coma patient would lose the being made in the image of God part of him. So it's not that. It can't be that. It's something that you have from the moment you come into existence, which would be conception. It's not potential. Again, it can't be potential because a baby in the womb, is, as far as we know, we don't know what level of consciousness they have, babies in the womb. But even if you say a baby in the womb is fully conscious to the point that we understand consciousness, well, that only proves the point. If you say that the baby is not conscious, well, then why does a coma patient get to still claim the image of God if they're a Christian, yet the unborn baby in the womb can't? So there are a lot of illogical, there's a lot of fallacies that come up when thinking in terms of being pro-abortion and being a Christian. It really doesn't fit. It doesn't mesh. I've never heard a single coherent argument for it. But there is a scourge of pro-abortion, and this has to be the central issue for Christians and conservatives alike. Now, to be frank, I really don't care for the term pro-choice, because the truth is, we're all in favor of certain choices when it comes to the unborn. We actually only differ on one of the choices. So the choice we differ on is literally life and death. That's the choice that we differ on. The pro-life stance offers several choices to women when it comes to making a decision that could result in the conception of a human being. Okay, there's a lot of choices. There's adoption, contraception, abstinence, and of course, motherhood. Those are four choices. But the only choice the pro-life stance does not consider reasonable is the fifth choice, murder. That's the only part. So therefore, both sides of this argument are pro-choice. They each just have a very different view as to what constitutes a human life and by extension, murder. Now, the reason this issue is so important and should be taken more seriously than any other issue is because of the pro-life definition. If the pro-life definition of human life is correct, let's say that it is, then abortion is responsible for over 60 million deaths since the Roe v. Wade decision to legalize abortion in 1973. And by contrast, the Holocaust was responsible for an estimated 11 to 17 million deaths, 6 million of which were Jews. The highest estimates of death attributed to Joseph Stalin were between 20 and 30 million. Even Mao Zedong's Great Leap Forward policy, resulting in what is largely accepted as the biggest episode of mass murder ever recorded, comes in at up to 45 million deaths. Still fewer than abortion. If human life has intrinsic value in the womb, then abortion is responsible for the largest case of mass murder ever committed against the human race. Now, to a pro-abortionist, the unborn baby in the womb is not a real human being. Human rights begin at birth rather than conception. However, this view is littered with inconsistencies that are fairly easy to point out. For example, most in the political left who are in favor of abortion would agree slavery is a very harmful and destructive part of American and European history. Now, much of what spurred on slavery was the idea that people of other strange cultures were less than human and more comparable to animals. Many believed these newly discovered people lacked a human soul. Christians even debated whether or not to even bother sharing the gospel with them. Seeing them as non-human beings made it easier to enslave them. So thinking of them as animals made it easier to treat them as such. Now, most on the political left and, well, really right for that matter, lament the choices made by our ancestors and would wish, if they didn't know, they would have erred on the side of caution. You know, if the people back then didn't know if people of other races were human or not, then it would have been better to err on the side of caution and treat them as human until they developed scientific studies or something, until they were able to prove it or whatever. But the left would agree that if there was a debate whether these biological entities were human or not, it would have been better to assume humanity. Any conceived consequences of calling them human would be far less extreme than the horrors which came from assuming they were not human. So pro-abortionists will generally agree to that premise. Yet, when it comes to abortion, they are not willing to remain consistent and assume humanity. They will not err on the side of caution. If we really don't know when life begins, whether at conception or at birth, it clearly would be better to assume humanity begins at conception. As with slavery, any conceived consequences that could arise from assuming humanity at conception are far less extreme than the mass murder of over 60 million people as a result of assuming babies in the womb are not really human. It is far better to err on the side of caution. Now, an argument that frequently comes from pro-abortion people is that a fetus in the womb is not really a human, but a potential human. Though this term is never really clearly defined. When does a potential human become a human? Is it at birth? What about premature babies born weeks earlier than they were supposed to be? Is sustainability the issue? If a baby can survive on its own outside of the womb, is that when it is considered to be a human? And what about an adult coma patient? We talked about that just a minute ago, who cannot survive on his own. If sustainability is the issue, is he now no longer considered human? Apparently not, because there are still laws protecting the lives of premature babies and coma patients. We even have laws protecting the eggs of certain wildlife, like alligators and endangered birds and things. If a fetus in the womb is considered potential life and is therefore meaningless, consistency would dictate that this definition would stretch across all species capable of producing potential life. However, you would be hard-pressed to find any pro-abortionist who thinks that it should be legal to destroy bald eagle eggs, for example. We have very strict laws protecting the potential life, according to the pro-abortionist definition, of bald eagles, but not for our own species, not for humankind. Now, another extremely weak, yet unfortunately common, argument for abortion in an attempt to show the hypocrisy of pro-lifers goes something like this. You want to protect the babies in the womb, but once they're born, you don't care about them at all. Now, this argument is usually an attempt to call out conservatives for not wanting their taxes to pay for government funding programs and things like that. But once again, this line of logic remains inconsistent. Let's say you see someone trapped in a burning building. You rush in, you save them. Are you now financially responsible for that person for the rest of your life just because you wanted to save their life? Should every doctor who has ever saved someone's life be financially responsible for their patients? Or if somebody saves a baby from drowning, are they now the baby's caretaker forever? There is no other part of American law or culture or reasonability or logic that would work like that. Yet this argument is repeated frequently. Even Joy Behar stupidly claimed it on The View a couple of months ago. But just because we want babies to live and not die does not mean that we are obligated to financially support them. That is the job of the family. All right. Now, inevitably, when the abortion issue is raised, someone brings up rape, incest, and possible health issues. But the truth is, studies show that this is rarely, if ever, the reason for abortion. So according to a compiled estimate percentages with the range of value given in parentheses, when you actually look up this statistic, the reason for abortion in the U.S. breaks down as such, and I'll read it in a minute, but this comes from johnstonsarchive.net/policy/abortion/abrasion. So if you want to look up the statistic, you can. Rape is 0.3%, not even 1%. It's 0.3%, and it's in a range of 0.1 to 0.6. Incest, again, 0.3%, and it is in a range of 0.01 to 0.1%. So 0.03. Oh, it's not 0.3. Excuse me. Incest is 0.03. Physical life of the mother. That is 0.1% within a range of 0.01 to 0.2%. Physical health of the mother is 0.8%. So, and that is 0.1 to 3%. Fetal health is 0.5%, 0.1 to 1%. And elective, 98.3% or 87 to 99%. So that's convenience. It's not health issues. It's not rape. It's not incest. It's not physical life of the mother, physical health of the mother, fetal health. It's not anything like that. 98.3% of abortions occur because of elective. Now, what is elective? We can break that down. The category of elective in this study includes too young, immature, or not ready for responsibility, economic, to avoid adjusting life, the mother is single or in a poor relationship, the mother has enough children already, sex selection, or selective reduction. So even though rape, incest, and threats to physical life or health are commonly used as arguments to support abortion, these by and large are not the reasons abortion services are utilized. And a way you can tell that pro-abortionists actually do not typically care about these horrific issues is you can ask them, if given the chance, if pro-lifers agreed to allow abortion only for rape, incest, and threat to life, or health, would you then give up elective abortion? Not a single one of them would take that deal. Because, again, they would be cutting out 98.7% or 98.3% of their abortions, excuse me. Not a single one of them would take that deal. And by the way, we should never take that deal either. That's a terrible deal. Now, you know, of course it would save lives, but still, it's a good thought exercise to point out the inconsistencies in the pro-abortion argument concerning rape, incest, and threat to life or health. There are no pro-abortion. They are not pro-abortion because of these tragic yet extremely rare instances. Now, the pro-abortion stance is not based in logic or reason, but instead is based on emotion and faith, actually. Faith that a fetus in the womb is not a human. Faith that it is not murder to strip a baby from its mother's womb. Faith that there is no God to judge these things. Faith that morality is relative. Faith that there is no objective right or wrong. But the thing is, we Christians have faith too. We have faith in the opposite of all of those things. The difference is, however, we do not have to bring our faith into the pro-life argument at all. Sometimes we as Christians will do that, but we don't actually have to do that. Our position does not have to hinge on faith. Our position can be thoroughly explained logically, reasonably, and scientifically without having to bring in our personal beliefs of God or even Christianity. Now, as you'll notice, until now, I have not focused too heavily on the Bible or God throughout this abortion topic. I did a little bit in the beginning, but most of the arguments, even though I'm talking mostly to a Christian audience, most of the arguments are based in just reason and logic. And I did this to show that we can debate these things on the left's own terms. We can go onto their own land intellectually and argue these things. If they don't believe in a God, fine. Let's argue these things scientifically. But even if there was no God, our position still holds true. Even if the Bible is full of errors and deemed unreliable, our position still holds true. Even if Christianity is full of bullies and tyrants who did nothing else but oppress people all throughout history, still our position holds true. It has nothing to do with the content of our character. It's based in science, logic, and reason. And it does, and the pro-abortionist argument does not hold up to scrutiny against these things. Now, of course, there are many, many very legitimate spiritual reasons to oppose abortion and many arguments that can be made from the Bible and God's clear wishes on the matter. And if a Christian is considering supporting abortion, we absolutely should utilize those arguments. And I mentioned a few of those at the beginning. However, this is rare. This is still rare. Most often, it's people who do not accept God or religion of any kind who support abortion. You can have a pro-life atheist. There are actually many out there. Yet you can't really have a pro-abortion Christian. Now, again, that I'm not putting salvation in that. The way that I look at it, somebody can be saved. But what it means to be a Christian is to take the next step and to follow Christ and to mirror your ideals with his. And every day of your life, you're trying to get better. So just being saved and being a Christian is two different things. You can take a job and quit the next day and still technically you had that job, or you can keep that job and make that your career. You could think of it like that. So that's why I say you can't really have a pro-abortion Christian, somebody who's actually following Christ and the teachings of the Bible, especially with something as foundational as what life is and if murder is wrong. Now, this is why in this video I presented these arguments outside of spirituality by and large. Christian arguments against abortion are important, but they are really only effective by and large with other Christians. A non-believer could certainly hear some good Christian arguments, become convicted, accept Jesus and become pro-life, and we should celebrate every time that happens, yet it's better to have the best of both worlds. So individually, each and every one of us should put out the Christian response first, because our first priority should be to witness to people and make disciples of all nations, and that will fix a lot of the problems that we have with our opponents. But collectively, however, We should be ready for the debates when they come. The truth is, we can convince anyone of any belief system that abortion is wrong as long as that person is willing to meet us on the same ground of logic and reason and facts instead of relying on emotion. If they're not willing, then honestly, they have no place discussing or enforcing an opinion on the matter in the first place. The pro-life side has the most logical and consistent arguments on its side. The more we can share those arguments with the world while at the same time taking up the task of the Great Commission, the more lives we can hopefully save physically and eternally. So I wanted to talk about that. I am curious, as always, to know your opinions on this matter. Go ahead and leave me a comment in the comment section below. All right. Now, I did an interview with Michael Knowles from the Daily Wire, and I've also interviewed in the past Andrew Klavan from the Daily Wire. And I've noticed a similar trend with both of these interviews. Both of these guys have extremely large audiences, way bigger than mine, way bigger than Skywatch TV. And usually when I can interview somebody with a large audience like that, then I get a lot of views. You know, I get a lot of response. When I interviewed Michael Stevens, you know, Vsauce from YouTube, at the time I interviewed him, he had just over 10 million subscribers. Huge, and he's got way more now. But when I interviewed him, that is still my highest viewed video my most viewed video on Into the Multiverse, right? So you would expect that. It's 600,000 views now, something like that. That's what you expect. And there's actually a way that you can kind of do the math with a bit of probability, but you can do the math, and in within a certain scale, you can kind of you should be able to work out how many views you can expect. And you know, there are different factors to take in. It's not always accurate, but the times that I have done this before YouTube started cracking down on censorship, it was accurate enough that I was satisfied with it. So I interviewed Andrew Klavan on Into the Multiverse three times. All three of them are among my lowest viewed videos. It's not Andrew Klavan's fault. It's not Into the Multiverse's fault. It's not Daily Wire. It's not me. It's not you guys. It's that the audience isn't being told. And that was the response that I got from most people, is that they got no notification. They didn't know that I did that interview, that I did those interviews. Well, just recently I did an interview with Michael Knowles on this channel, who again has a huge audience. And that one is about 200 or 300 views right now. And it's been days. Now I talk about Bigfoot in a video for 10 minutes, and that gets over 100,000 views. Even my weekly shows, you know, which this is, but they're not highly rated, but even those will get three or four times as much as that interview did. And I've had correspondence with YouTube in the past that has convinced me that they are, and I've done videos on that before. I've read the emails to you guys, although you probably didn't see the video because YouTube refuses to allow these things out there. But I'm convinced that this channel is being shadow banned. And any time that I put politically conservative or Christian labels or in the title or in the description, then it sets off the algorithm to suppress it, you know, to kind of put it in the dark corner of the internet. And there's been many examples of this, even just straight up censorship, like what happened with Alex Jones recently, which, again, and I say this in the interview, whether you love him or hate him, that should not have happened to him. That was, in my estimation, an evil move on the parts of the conspiratorial YouTube, Facebook, Apple, and Spotify, and I think there was one other, Google or something. But I think that was evil. Doesn't matter what you think about Alex Jones. If you want to represent American values, then you should respect free speech. I know that private corporations don't have to. But still, there are things that are legal that are still not good. All right. Adultery is legal, but it's not good to cheat on your wife. So So I wanted to put that interview at the end of this video because I'm curious to see. I'm not going to put it in the tags. I'm not going to put it in the description. I'm not going to say anything about Daily Wire or Michael Knowles anywhere in the metadata. But I'm curious to see if this video gets more views. That would be interesting if it gets more than 200 or 300 views, which I suspect it will. But anyway, so all that being said, here is my interview with Michael Knowles from the Daily Wire. Michael Knowles hosts the Michael Knowles Show on the Daily Wire. Make sure you check it out. It's funny, witty, informative, and believe it or not, in our political climate, it's actually positive. He's also an actor, author, conservative, political commentator, and columnist. He wrote what is probably the most in-depth and well-researched book I've ever read in my life, and I would even count my own in there. Reasons to Vote Democrat, a comprehensive guide. It is my pleasure to welcome Michael Knowles to Josh Peck Disclosure. Michael, how you doing?
Josh, I'm doing very well, and I can tell that you're a real scholar for having read my book. I'm really pleased to hear that.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's only 266 pages, but it's a very deep 266 mm-hmm. pages. It took me 8 years to complete, so 6 years longer than the book has even been out.
That's right. Well, it took me well over 20 years to research it, but I hope that all of that information is digestible, edifying for people who want to find out all of the reasons to vote for Democrats.
Yes, I agree. People should definitely check that out, and people should also read the Amazon reviews if they don't believe us on how amazing of a book it is.
Oh, yes, there are 3,000 very insightful conservatives have given their thoughts on the most important political magnum opus of our generation.
I love it. And who said conservatives don't have a sense of humor?
That's right.
So I want to start out, people in our culture, even many of those on the conservative side, you know, speaking of having a sense of humor and stuff, it seems a lot of people generally kind of overall seem to have an overall dismal outlook on our current time. Yet on your show, you always project a really positive outlook, which my wife and I and even our kids thoroughly enjoy. Why are you so optimistic, and why don't you just fall in line with everyone else and allow depression and anxiety to consume you until you're nothing but a dry, withered husk of your former youthful self?
That's right. It's like the line, my priest told me the line about the Scottish optimist and the Scottish pessimist. You know, the Scottish pessimist says things couldn't get any worse, and the Scottish optimist says, oh, yes, they can. That is what it seems like among conservatives sometimes. But there are a few reasons. One, Winston Churchill observed, for myself, I'm an optimist. It doesn't make a lot of sense to be anything else. That's part of it. But I don't think it's just a sort of shallow or blind optimism. When you look around for the first time in a long time, things are going well. They're not just going a little well, they're going very well. As a matter of politics, you know, the economy is booming, joblessness is at an all-time low, employment is at an all-time high. You've got trade deals that are being reworked that hasn't caused a trade war, that hasn't caused global recession. Things actually seem to be doing a bit better. The IMF credits the Trump administration for the boost in the global economy. On foreign affairs, we have relative peace abroad. We have potentially denuclearizing of North Korea, potentially denuclearizing of Iran. That would be quite good. On matters of sort of international silliness, you know, President Trump left the Paris Accord and we were told the sky would fall. Last time I checked, the sky is doing just fine. And on the cultural level, what's so important, because look, as a matter of domestic politics, the government is being deregulated. That's a very good thing. All of a sudden, the left is discovering the wonders of local government. They're saying, oh, perhaps we shouldn't give all of this power to the federal government. That's very good. And on a cultural level, for the first time in my life and in the lifetime of most millennials I know, the conservatives are the ones having fun. The conservatives are the ones who have an exuberance. I mean, we cite the blank book, but what the blank book is indicative of are all of those commenters and all of those reviewers who are having a little bit of fun finally. They're willing to shake out of their doer sensibilities, and they're saying, oh, things are quite nice. They can breathe. All of the late night comedians are crying on television. There is a comedy special, so-called comedy special, on Netflix called Nanette. It's this anti-comedy comedy. It's just a woman complaining for an hour about how difficult her life is. Yeah, that's a ha ha ha, not a lot of comedy. Meanwhile, on the right, you know, people are having a good time because there's a little light. You know, it was Horace Walpole, I think, the English writer, who said that life is a comedy to the man who thinks and a tragedy to the man who feels. This seems to tie in nicely to Ben Shapiro's line about how facts don't care about your feelings. When you're in this tyranny of subjectivism, this tyranny of emotions, like you're seeing on the left, everything is so sad and upsetting and terrible. But when you just think, you look around, you have a little historical perspective, and you can see into the near future just a little bit, perhaps, things are going relatively very, very, very well for us. I see no reason to frown.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a time like no other that I can remember in my lifetime, which isn't very long. I'm only 34. But still, I mean, it's kind of nice to be able to be happy and excited about politics. Whereas for me personally, before Trump, I really didn't have much of an interest in politics, but Trump kind of cured that for me. And now I'm all in.
That's right. And, you know, one other aspect of Trump, because he jokes around, even just that, it breaks some of that tyranny of self-seriousness where they say, oh, you can't say that. You should. Oh, no, you're really this, or then you're so nervous to say any word. I talked to my friends on the left. I had a lefty comedian come in, and he's coming out of this a little bit, but he would preface everything that he said with 17 apologies. I say, you don't have to apologize. This is a safe space. There's free air here. The other thing that President Trump has done that's pretty nice is that he has broken this ideological rigidity that I think had settled in even on the right. It had always settled in on the left, but on the right, we had gotten to be a little bit of a checklist sort of people. And ideology is always wrong. Mm-hmm. Ideology is the sort of thing you write down on a piece of paper and you say, the entire world, the whole universe, my experience of reality is on this piece of paper and everything else isn't true. And when people get ideological, they lose their sense of the world. When things don't comport with their ideological predictions, they go a little crazy. But I think one nice aspect of the Trump era is, hey guys, stop worrying about if something works in theory, if it works in practice. There is a practical knowledge to life that really matters. And I think we're seeing the fruits of that.
Yeah, it reminds me of what you said today on your show. It was either today or yesterday. I believe it was today, about how Trump's really genuine because he doesn't fit into any one of these ideologies. He's kind of a little bit of everything, but that makes him genuine. And he doesn't speak precisely. He's not exact about his language, but that also adds a lot of genuineness to him. And speaking of language, you recently did a PragerU video on the importance of language. Do you see a difference of approach to language between the political right and left? And if so, why do you think those differences arise?
Well, that is certainly the case. The left uses a lot of jargon and language that people in reality don't recognize. You hear them all the time. You hear these little tells when Cory Booker speaks or somebody. they talk about the folks, and they talk about being an ally, and they talk about intersectionality and social justice. And they don't say illegal alien. They say undocumented future American dreaming superstar. Well, I don't know, whatever language they use. And it's increasingly disconnected from reality. And this gets to ideology as well, which is that ideology in so many ways is just like a bag of vocabulary. You know the ideology by the words that people use. When you hear Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the socialist star of the Democrats, when you hear her talking about late-stage capitalism and class conflict, you know that she's coming to politics from a Marxist ideological perspective. You don't hear that on the right. Now, for a long time, I think the right has allowed ourselves to get trapped in the left's language. But once you use their language, you give up the whole game. And another great aspect of the Trump era, I remember this well from the 2016 campaign. He was using the word anchor babies, you know, when someone comes to America just to have a kid and then the kid gets birthright citizenship. And some journalists, by journalist, I mean Democrat operative masquerading as a journalist.
Right.
Some journalists said, don't you know, Mr. Trump, that the word anchor baby is very offensive? And Trump said, well, how is it offensive? What word should I use? And the guy said, you know, you've got to use the phrase undocumented future or dreaming, whatever. And Trump stares at him while he gets out this 20-second phrase. And then Trump looks at him, he says, I think I'm going to stick with anchor baby. I think that's going to work just fine. That freedom to say, no, we're not going to use your ridiculous manipulative language. We're going to speak freely. I mean, I think it really came to a head with the gender pronoun battles.
Yeah.
Because the left is, there's now so divorced from reality. They are forcing us. In certain countries, at the foot of a gun, they're saying, you need to call men women.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to call women men. And if you don't do it, we're going to punish you for that. And I think that was a bridge too far. I think some people just said, no, I don't tell me to disbelieve my lying eyes. I can see in front of me that person is a man. And that very basic thing, I think, has led to a lot of great advancement in political language. We're finally free of some of those shackles.
Yeah, I agree. And it shows a lot of the hypocrisy, too, because if they're so strong and empowered and everything, like they shout at the rest of us, why is something as simple as a pronoun enough to crumble their entire existence? Literally, as they say it, you know, you're stealing my existence, my humanity away. And that's not what it is at all, of course.
It's funny that you bring up that example, because they use this phrase. You might not hear it if you're in the mainstream of the culture, but you hear it on the fringes, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, on all of the college campuses. The phrase that they will use on the left to refer to conservatives, they'll say, for instance, if you disagree with a conservative, what have you done? You've just disagreed with them. You've said, okay, I don't agree with your opinion. And the conservative says, okay, well, too bad.
Yeah.
if you disagree with a lefty, the phrase that you increasingly hear is, you're erasing me.
Yeah.
This is erasure. You're erasing my lived identity. Because for them, the essence of not only political identity, but personal identity, because to the left, the personal is the political. The essence is this ideology. When you disagree with that opinion, you have rejected them personally. And that's a ridiculous point of view. And we should obviously laugh at it. I think it would be better, certainly for society, but it would be better for them. They'd be less angry and maddened all the time.
Yeah, maybe they'd actually be able to grow and learn some new things, as we all should be doing. Now, and I think this might be contributing to the destruction of the leftist culture. I mean, right now the lefties kind of own the culture. But do you think that conservatives are going to win the culture back? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, I don't know. In the long run, we're all dead, to quote John Maynard Keynes.
Right.
And when you look broadly at the modern era from, say, the Protestant Revolution to the present, I don't know that on the long run we're going to recover the culture into any serious moral or political sense.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be good blips. There can be good little bits of recovery. And we're seeing that now. We are seeing at least the pendulum swing back a little. You see it with Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Right.
You know, Christmas, the Christmas is the holiday that must not be named. And the left always denies this. They say, there's no war on Christmas. You crazy conservatives think there's a war on Christmas. And you say, okay, well, if there's no war on Christmas, then just say Merry Christmas. They say, no, we have to say Happy Holidays. So, well, what are the other holidays that are going on? They say, well, what about Hanukkah? You say, well, Hanukkah was a month ago. Say, okay, well, what about Kwanzaa? Nobody celebrates Kwanzaa. Well, what about the winter solstice? Do you celebrate the winter solstice? No, it's because they don't want to use that phrase, because the left is essentially opposed to the very civilization that created it, Western civilization. And that's what it is. When you have a culture that kind of breaks free of those shackles, then, as you've been seeing for the last year or so, people are more willing to say Merry Christmas. They're more willing to use the word illegal alien rather than these silly euphemisms. They're willing to use precise language. And one way that conservatives can win back the culture is by using precise language. Don't give them these little inches, because when you lose language, you lose entire premises. This was the question of gay marriage.
This
is where this came up most clearly. Some conservatives say, oh, it's fine, who cares? We can redefine marriage, it doesn't matter. And that's a fair argument for them to have, I suppose. But what the left did is they changed, using language, they changed that debate. The debate was whether we should redefine marriage to include monogamous same-sex unions. For some reason, not polygamous same-sex unions, but just specifically monogamous same-sex unions. Should we redefine marriage that way? Does sexual difference have something to do with marriage? Do men and women have something to do with marriage? And they subverted that entirely by saying, do you have the right? Do gay people have the right to marriage? Presupposing that marriage already included monogamous same-sex unions.
Right.
And once it's a question of rights, yeah, of course, everybody should have equal rights. But that was never the debate. They just tricked us with language.
Yeah, we see that a lot too. But I think in the Trump era, more people on the right, instead of feeling bad about it or feeling guilty or feeling like they've done something wrong or offended somebody, I think conservatives more now, especially younger millennial ones like you and I, are starting to kind of wake up and realize, you know what, that really doesn't matter, because this is the truth, and whatever you want to, you know, whatever fantasy you want to play in is just not going to hold water there. I don't even know if this is possible at this point, to have a functioning culture where both the left and the right could somehow coexist and have productive conversations and things like that. I mean, obviously we're coexisting now. We're not, at least not yet, blowing each other up or anything like that. But what would the left have to do to maintain their hold on the culture in a way that the right could go along with to at least in some sense?
Well, we are certainly coexisting. There's no civil war yet. Right. And this is probably smart of the left, because the right has all the guns. So it would probably not behoove them to start a civil war anytime soon. But the real breakdown is this breakdown of language. If you want to be able to communicate, then you have to agree on objective definitions of words. If we don't have objective definitions of words, then you're just a bunch of screaming animals, aren't you? You're just grunting. And politics ceases to be a discourse and a debate over different areas and over different generations, and it becomes a brute force battle of individual interests that can never coincide. This is what the left is descending into. There was a video of Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens from TPUSA. They were at some event, and there were protesters just shrieking in their face, not really shrieking words, just shrieking sounds. Yeah. And that's a great metaphor for what has happened broadly in the culture. We're not using the same language. We're not agreeing on terms. The left is the aggressor in that. It's because of a radical subjectivism. It's because they're saying, oh, no, words don't have meaning. It's just whatever we say things are, that's how we're going to get along in society. If we're going to use certain language and depict reality in a certain way, and then poof, magically, it's going to become that way. That isn't going to happen. There's certainly not going to be any way for the left and the right to coexist if we're just forcing one another to believe each other's ridiculous fantasy of reality. What we have to do, rather, is agree on aspects of reality. And right now, the conservative, and I think for a very long time, conservatives have a better hold on that. And the left is truly out there in la-la land. It's up to them. We, you know, it would be very nice to say, oh, you guys come this far and we'll come this far. But you can't meet in the middle when it's a question of reality and fantasy. You really have to have the left come debate in good faith, on honest terms, about whether we want socialist health care, or whether we want to redefine marriage, or whether we want to raise taxes, or whatever. If you're not debating those things in good faith, then we can't meet in the middle.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the language is so important. That event that you messaged or that you referenced, one of the things that they were screaming was F white supremacy. But they, white women mostly, but what white people were screaming that at a black woman.
That's right.
I mean, talk
that's
about
what
hypocrisy.
Saying.
I mean, it's projecting. Yeah.
Yes, they are. They are always projecting. Yeah. They, you know, it's all of these white women. When they weren't just shrieking sounds, they said F white supremacy, and they were yelling at Candace Owens, a black woman. And the irony here is that they are the ones projecting a white supremacy. Mm. They're the ones saying, you black woman have to think and behave and talk exactly like we tell you to. And if not, we're going to get in your face and we're going to physically intimidate you. They're always doing that. But, you know, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You need a little bit of humility and a little bit of awe and reverence to have wisdom. And the left has rejected all of that. The left hosts pride marches, not just gay pride, not just LGBT LMNOP pride, pride for every aspect of their coalition. And, you know, pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. If you've got one side that is utterly without humility, then you're never going to be able to communicate, for one, and you're never going to be even self-aware to begin that conversation.
Amen. And you know what's another piece of hypocrisy that kind of came out today was you know, they'll take part in these protests, and I think protesting is fine, you know, in principle, but they'll enjoy their right to free speech and stuff, but then they don't value that same right. Like, for example, you know, regardless of what the audience thinks about the guy, Alex Jones got banned from basically the internet today. And
that's right.
I just total censorship. And, you know, listen, I don't agree with everything that he says, but I still think he should have the right to say it. And but at the same time, YouTube is a corporation. They can do what they want. But it kind of shows that they don't maintain the same American values that they also enjoy. And
Of course.
Yeah. This led me to a question, because I've experienced this a lot. I actually used to get a couple hundred thousand views on every video I did. Now I'm lucky if I get a few hundred. Sorry to tell you that now after you have agreed to the interview. But
we'll try to tweet it out, and they censor me every now and again, but maybe we'll be able to get through big tech's big censorship.
Yeah, that'd be great. Anything you can do. But I was wondering, I've noticed it here and at Skywatch TV, have you guys at the Daily Wire experienced censorship on social media like YouTube? And if so, have you had any success in fighting against it?
Absolutely, we have. My show is regularly censored on Facebook and YouTube, and it's ebbed and flowed. At certain times, they'll knock every show that I do. Sometimes they give us a little breathing room. I think it depends on the whims of these executives when they wake up in the morning in Silicon Valley. Luckily now, we're at least being able to reach more of an audience than a couple months ago. They were really dinging us. And it's that capriciousness, it's that arbitrariness that has conservatives worried. You mentioned Alex Jones. I mean, Alex Jones is a conspiratorial, frequently incoherent vitamin salesman who takes his shirt off on camera. But we should defend him. We should defend him from censorship. It's very funny that Apple, Google, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all of these guys decided that the best way they were going to prove a conspiracy theorist wrong was at the same time banning him. Right? He's like, I'm ready to break out my tinfoil hat. And the reason is, do I think that Alex Jones has a strong grasp on public policy? No. Although I do sometimes listen to him late at night on the radio because he can be an entertaining broadcaster. Sure. But no, I don't think he's a conservative. I don't think he's part of the conservative movement. But the conservatives should defend him, because for the left right now, while we might be able to see the distinction between the various commentators and writers and thinkers on the right, to the left, there is no difference between Alex Jones and William F. Buckley Jr. Yeah. What they are doing is they're censoring Jones because it's easy, because he's a little kooky, and they're censoring him as a way of establishing the principle to further censor the rest of us. We've all been censored to one degree or another already, and it seems to me by today's actions that it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, and that's something that I appreciate about your show, too, is because you'll welcome liberals on who are willing to talk to you. And I just got to say, on a personal note, the Tom Arnold interview, that not only made my day, that probably made my year.
You know, when Tom came in, we had to redo the set because it was like a Tasmanian devil coming through. But I got to tell you, I've got to give Tom Arnold a lot of credit.
Sure.
The interview was pretty wild. wasn't the most staid interview ever. But I got to give him credit. I invite Democrats and non-conservatives on all the time. Two people have said yes. Tom Arnold and a comedian by the name of Jamie Kilstein. Those are the only two that say yes. I invite Democrats on all the time. They won't come on because they don't want to have an exchange of ideas. They don't want to debate or discuss anything. They just want to hurl vicious slander. They call every conservative a racist and a bigot and this, totally baselessly. And then they want to censor us. When it's not enough to slander us, they censor us.
And I think that what you're doing and what I'm trying to do and what many other conservatives out there are doing, I think that is eventually what is going to win over some of the more not as far left liberals out there, because we hear a lot of former liberals say, you know, I didn't leave liberalism or leftism or whatever, liberalism left me. So if the left continues pushing farther and farther left, do you think that it will end in the collapse of society as a whole, or do you think that just more and more people will eventually become conservative?
Well, there are two sides to this. In the short run, this is a wonderful thing for the country and for conservatives, because you saw at that Netroots conference over the weekend, the Democrat Party is running hard left. Mm. They are embracing socialists after a century trying to distance themselves from socialists. They're saying abolish law enforcement. They're saying no borders, amnesty for all illegal aliens. And we see the public polling. Those issues are all losers among the American people. They are ghettoizing themselves electorally, and they're going to lose votes in the short run. And we're also seeing this even just when you look at various electoral coalitions. Just this week, a big headline is that President Trump's support among black voters has nearly doubled in just a few months. It went from 15% to 29%. These are all good things. The trouble, of course, is in the long run, because in the long run, we're seeing the oldest continually existent political party in the world, the Democrat Party, is now embracing really dangerous ideas and really fringe ideas and really awful ideas like socialism.
Yes.
And in the long run, that's going to have a corrosive effect on society because these ideas might not win in 2018 or 2020, but at some point there will be a crisis, the left will grab onto it, and the consequences won't be very good. It's why conservatives have to both celebrate their craziness now, but also pretty vigorously refute these awful ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and they're really getting them young, too. I mean, due to the vast amount of indoctrination from our education system, do you think, I mean, especially in the universities, do you think that many millennials today actually probably are more conservative than they think, but just don't realize it yet because they hear, you know, conservative and they think Nazi and racist, yet a lot of them want to go out and like start a small business or something?
That's true. I must take a little Shapiro-esque pessimism here, though, because I don't think millennials think very much at all. Millennials are perhaps the worst educated generation in history,
yes,
but they're the most credentialed. So they think that they're very educated. But socialists since Lenin and Stalin have relied on useful idiots to push their pernicious ideology. Mm. We now know, just a lot of public polling shows, that the majority of American millennials would fail a basic civics test. On a national survey, only 40% of people could name, 40% of respondents couldn't name a single aspect of the First Amendment. Only 1 in 1,000 could name every aspect, all of the rights, religion, speech, freedom of the press, right, all of those rights. Very few people know that. Something like 90% of American millennials cannot explain what checks and balances is. They cannot explain our federal system. A huge majority of them can't explain the purpose of the Bill of Rights. And this is because their education has been empty. They haven't learned foundational aspects of civics or history or literature. They've learned ideology. Instead of the history textbook, they're reading A People's History of the United States, that polemic propaganda by Howard Zinn. They're learning ideological disciplines, women's studies instead of history, say, ethnicity studies. The way we pillory it is a lesbian dance theory or something,
right.
You know. They're learning all of this nonsense, so they don't have a depth of education. And if you don't know anything, if you don't stand for anything, then you'll fall for anything. I think that's what we're seeing now. Millennials were born after the fall of the Berlin Wall. They don't even have a visceral knowledge of communism. They didn't see it with their own eyes, and that does not bode well for us.
And it seems to me, generally speaking, that conservatives are more likely to self-educate. And because of that, you know, conservatives typically argue with logic and leftists argue with emotion. If leftists won't listen to logic, what do you find is the best way to get through to a leftist? Or is it just a pointless endeavor to even try?
Humor is the way. Humor is the way to do it, because you're right. Conservatives broadly self-educate because they have to.
Yes,
there's no
yeah.
alternative. How else do you read conservative works? And even by conservative works, I even mean the great books. I mean foundational texts in addition to conservative political philosophy. You're not going to get it in your K-12 education. You're not going to get it on university campuses broadly. So you have to self-educate. If the left is unwilling to do that, if they're in these bubbles and cocoons in their safe spaces where they never have to encounter their own prejudices, then the way that you can convince them and convince others is to mock their stupid ideas. Humor is a powerful, powerful tool. And joy goes a long way in politics, and it's very persuasive. Nikki Haley, our wonderful ambassador to the UN,
yes,
made a slight error, I felt, a couple weeks ago, which is that she denigrated the phrase owning the libs, you know,
right,
using humor to sort of mock the left. I think owning the libs is the great way forward. If they're not going to be able to engage logically, you can make them laugh and you can make people watching them laugh because it will tickle something that is deeper, a sort of practical knowledge will be tickled by that. And I think it will show the absurdity of leftist doctrine and dogma. You know, the dogma lives loudly within them. And so we got to shake them free of it, I think. And one way to do that is with a laugh.
Well, I can even speak to that to my own personal experience. I mentioned earlier that before Trump announced that he was going to run for president, I didn't really have much of an interest in politics, and I didn't really know what right versus left meant, or didn't really know any of it. But I got interested because Donald Trump is hilarious. You know, whether you love him or hate him, he's absolutely hilarious. I have a quote going around Skywatch that Derek Gilbert, the host of Skywatch TV, quoted me as saying, if Donald Trump wins, the world might end, but at least it'll be hilarious.
that's exactly right. That is exactly right. What a way to go out. You know, at least you're going out in a sort of free way and in a free culture. No, that humor is so important. And Trump is a master of it. But there's an exuberance on the right that you see anyway. Yeah. We were talking about the blank book earlier. The blank book is an old joke. It actually in America, it goes back all the way to the 1880 presidential election. The Republican ticket of James Garfield and Chester Arthur. Part of their campaign material was they published a blank book called The Political Achievements and Statesmanship of My Opponent, General Hancock, the Democrat nominee for president. That is, so clearly there's good provenance for this joke in the GOP side, but that is owning the libs, and that's using humor to do it. And we've let our humor fall into disuse over the past 20 years. We've been a little too earnest, I think. And that gets tedious. Self-seriousness gets tedious. And the Chesterton quote is that angels can fly because they can take themselves lightly. That's very attractive.
Yes, definitely. To kind of wrap it up here, I know you're busy and I don't want to keep you too long, but we've heard a lot about, you know, how to win the culture back, but how, being that language is so incredibly important, how can conservatives win the language back?
The way to win the language back is to be diligent. You have to have immense attention to detail. And this creates a little awkwardness sometimes. When somebody says to you, they're referring to a man who thinks he's a woman as a she, you have to say he.
Right.
I know this seems rude. We conservatives don't. We just want to be sort of amiable to everybody, and nobody wants to be rude to somebody in person. But when we're speaking about the culture, when we're speaking about broad things, you have to be precise in your language, because the only tool of the left is emotional manipulation, and their key tool to do that is language. In fact, they emotionally manipulate you to use their language. We should reject that utterly. And you know, it might take a little practice, because the indoctrination goes pretty deep. But you've really got to reach down and be precise in your language, because language is the stuff of our consciousness. Language is politics. It's how we communicate. Speech is that aspect. And so when you use precise language, you'll notice that the conversation shifts, not just personally, but culturally. We're already seeing that happen. And I think that is our best tool moving forward.
And like most things, it is worth the hard work that it takes to put in it. It is well worth it. To close up here, what do you want most for people to take away from this interview, your work, and your show?
Well, I hope that the book has convinced them of certain electoral aspects that they should pay attention to. But from that precision of language, I think that's very important, because one problem we were just talking about, how people don't know a lot about history, is if you just read a book written before you were born or before a century ago or two centuries ago, you'll see that people, different language creates different visions of the world. If you speak multiple languages, or if you read in different languages or whatever, even in different time frames, you'll say, oh, this culture at this time saw things a little differently. And then at this time, people saw things a little differently. And it really cools everything down, because we have such a bias, such a prejudice for the present. We're always on Twitter. We're always scrolling for whatever's new. The news cycle these days lasts about 45 seconds. And it's maddening, and it gets you very anxious. But if you get a little perspective, a little historical perspective, a little linguistic perspective, it will calm you down. Your life will be better. You can smile and embrace all of the covfefe. Speaking of creative uses of language, it will calm down the politics. It will make it much less rambunctious and angry and urgent.
That's right. Where can people go online to find more about you or catch your show?
Got to check out the show at dailywire.com. You can see it there, or on YouTube and Facebook when we're not being censored. And you can always find me on Twitter at Michael J. Knowles.
Yes, and everybody, make sure you do go to the Daily Wire. Make sure you sign up for the show. Subscribe, because he's got to make that money, honey.
Got to make that money, honey. And you'll get a leftist tears tumbler when you subscribe. And that's very important these days, because those tears are bountiful. They are flowing from the sky.
Oh, yeah. And ever since the Tom Arnold interview, you are well stocked. You got to get rid of some of your supply.
No, it's from drowning in here.
Well, this has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We're definitely going to have you back on again soon.
Josh, thanks for having me.
All right. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. I really like him. I like Michael Knowles a lot. He's a great guy, and it was a lot of fun talking to him. I want to have him back on the show. It's frustrating that I there are a lot of people I would like to have on the show. I can't make it worth it. You know, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. I mean, I turn down interviews if it's, I've got an extremely busy schedule and there's only so many things I can fit into a day. So when I speak publicly, I want to make sure that I can talk to as many people as possible. It has nothing to do with an ego trip or being famous or a popularity contest or anything like that. I've done smaller shows too. But typically, a lot of times I'll turn down smaller shows if I have a bigger show that I can do. And, you know, that's everybody. So I'm sympathetic to the fact that I send out a lot of requests to people who I've been asked by you guys to have on the show and I don't get a response back. And I understand why. They probably do the same thing I do. When I get an interview request from a show, I will go and look at their YouTube numbers. I'll go look at their website. I'll see if I can find what type of analytics I can. Now, I haven't been doing that as much lately because the YouTube numbers are skewed, as I've learned. There are a lot of times that, you know, a video will get 200 or 300 views, yet it'll have, you know, 100 or 200 comments, and that just doesn't happen. That doesn't work that way. You know, you're lucky. You're lucky if you get about 10% the comment, you know, 10% comments to view count. A lot of time, and the higher you go, you know, it's exponential. The higher you go, the less that percentage, the more that percentage drops. So the higher you go, maybe you'll get 1%. You know. So anyway. Enough ranting and raving about that, but that's why I wanted to play it on here. It's kind of an experiment, and I'm curious to know, you guys, if you were notified of the Michael Knowles interview when I put it up. If you haven't had a chance to do so, make sure you subscribe, you click the bell, tell YouTube that you want to be notified, and in case YouTube doesn't notify you, which it probably won't, every day you get a new video, and every week, every Friday, you get a longer weekly show like you've seen today. So, okay, everybody, I love you all. All that being said, I hope you have a great week. And until tomorrow, take care and God bless.
You can help fight against censorship by making a one-time donation or setting up a monthly donation to Josh Peck Disclosure at joshpeckdisclosure.com/donate. Or, for as little as $1 a month, you can become a Peck patron by heading over to patreon.com/joshpeck. As a Peck patron, you will be entered into contests to have your content featured on the Josh Peck Disclosure homepage, contribute chapters to a collaborative book with Josh Peck, and win a special Josh Peck collection full of materials worth hundreds of dollars. Also, for as little as $3 a month, you will have access to free downloads of Josh Peck books, such as Quantum Creation, Cherubim Chariots, and more. Josh Peck Disclosure is viewer-funded. Head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com for more information. Right now, head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com, the central hub for everything Josh Peck Disclosure. Every day, you'll get brand new videos, podcasts, updates, and more. Make sure you subscribe at youtube.com/joshpeckdisclosure. Also, make sure you click the bell and select the option to always be notified when a new video is released. Follow Josh Peck Disclosure on Twitter at jpdisclosure and get involved with the show on our official Facebook page at facebook.com/joshpeckdisclosure. Disclosure. If you're on Steemit and prefer DTube, follow Josh Peck at steemit.com/@Josh Peck and make sure to upvote all Josh Peck Disclosure DTube videos. Keep checking back at joshpeckdisclosure.com for news, information, updates, and more.